Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have my sometimes co-host, John Galloway of Microsoft. John, how are you?
Doing great.
Great. Today joining us is Phil Japixi, evangelist lead for DevTools and Telerik, a buddy and former boss, and James Bender, development evangelist for Just Tools at Telerik, and I'm going to presume to call you a buddy too, James. How are you, gentlemen?
Good.
Good.
How about yourself?
Good. Very good. Are you guys going to the Microsoft Summit in November?
I am going.
And this is Phil. I am not going because I will be speaking at VS Live. Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom, no pun intended, decided to schedule the MVP Summit right on top of the largest VS Live of the year.
What a drag, but cool that you're speaking there.
Yeah.
My favorite thing so far about the summit is that they said that they're going to give away a jacket, which, first of all, that's my favorite thing. But secondly, when you fill out the size, your choices are small, medium, large, extra, 2X, 3X, 4X, 5X, or 6X. They know their community.
So they go all the way up to developer medium.
Exactly. Exactly. So today we're going to be talking about test-driven development. And I have to say this year for me has been a real breakthrough year in not only sort of understanding the importance of TDD, which I have for a long time, but actually putting it into practice. And so I'm very eager to talk to both of you about test-driven development in general, the tools that Telerik makes in specifics, and anything else that you want to talk about relating to testing.
All right, great.
Okay.
So why don't we start with the assumption that anybody listening to this already knows the premise of test-driven development. And let me ask you what was always my first question, which is when you're learning about test-driven development, the importance of it is always driven home. But then you sit down in front of your Visual Studio or whatever your tool is, and you say, okay, I'm in the red phase for the red-green refactor. I'm in the red phase. I'm supposed to write a test before I have any code. And what the hell do I do first?
So, yeah, if we're agreeing that that premise is that you start with a test first, and that really seems to be a stumbling point for a lot of developers. They're used to an IntelliSense world where everything is already kind of there and baked, and they can just hit the tab and everything kind of expands out for them. When you're doing test-driven development, a lot of that is not there. You're writing tests against something that doesn't exist, be it the class or the method or whatever. So the first thing you got to get over is this idea that you have to kind of – you're kind of designing the API as you're going. You're the first user of it, and as you build out your test – you're not only deciding the name of your class, name of your method, you're deciding really what the parameter list is and what the expected result is.
Well, and I'm gonna back up a little bit because, Jesse, you said let's presume everybody knows the premise, but so many people think test-driven development or test-driven design is all about testing. And unfortunately, you know, that's not really what we're trying to do here. We're trying to drive out the design of our application in very small increments. And unfortunately in managed code, the only vehicle we have to do that is really unit tests. So unit tests are an awesome side effect of test-driven design, but it really isn't a focus because what I hear so many people say is, well, I don't need to do TDD because I have a QA department.
Yes, it's a very good point.
Right.
So let's drive a wedge between those two ideas. One is building tests that are going to help build your design and also be there to make sure that if you make changes, you'll know right away what broke on the one hand, and the business of QA, which is quite different on the other.
Right. And certainly having a large percentage of your application, you know, under test, as we say, or your code coverage, is an awesome thing to have and should be a goal. But really the whole facet behind test-driven development or test-driven design, as I like to call it, is I really want to drive through the design, making the best possible application I can without a whole lot of extra fluff. You know, Blaise Pascal once said, I apologize for length of this letter. I had not the time to make it shorter. And when we sit down and write without writing a test first, we tend to gold plate everything, right? oh, I might need this someday, so let me add this, and I might need this someday, and I might, you know, so I'm going to add that. And we end up with, you know, 100 line methods when really all we needed is 4 lines to make the requirements. So that's, you know, that's one of the goals that we try and do is make everything short and focused. And that makes it much more composable pieces that we can then build a tighter application with.
That's good to hear it explained that way. I mean, I've seen some people complain that when they focus too much on testing, then they end up with some of the Yagni stuff of componentizing everything and making everything, basically designing their application around testing. And that's taking it too far from what you're just explaining, which is the same thing. Like, you're writing your tests to drive what you need and not what you don't, right? So you hopefully that drives kind of that happy medium of building exactly what you need all the way through the app and focusing on what's necessary rather than kind of guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you first start out, you're going to get it wrong, right? I mean, you're just going to get it wrong. And the thing that we try and do is fail fast. That's the whole red-green refactor, right? We start red. Oop, we failed fast, right? Now we have to make it pass.
Okay, so the premise is, if we're talking red-green refactor, the premise is that you first write the test without any implementing code. You run it. You actually run that test to make it fail, if only so you know that it can fail and will fail under the right conditions. And then you write, presumably, just enough code to make that one test pass. Given that premise, how do you write that first test? What goes into that first test and second test?
Well, the first test, and it's different every time because every requirement's a little bit different and everybody's approach is a little bit different. But what I like to do is you get a requirement, I like to slice it up into test cases. And there's no magic number. It's every requirement has a different amount of test cases. But I like to slice into those test cases. And I like to start with the first most obvious test case and work that one. Then I kind of, at some point it becomes a judgment call. But what I like to do is I like to start with the smaller test cases, the easier test cases, maybe the ones that are more on that 80-20 side, the 80% side of that, and then kind of work towards a 20. What happens is the first kind of couple iterations, that code you write to make the test pass is going to be very lean and very, very simple. And that's good. That's kind of the point. And as you start adding those complexities with those additional tests, your code's obviously going to become a little bit more complex. But I like to start with the easier things first. And the other thing is, as developers, we tend to kind of overthink things. And it's very important that when you're writing these test cases, you're really writing only the test cases that are needed by the requirement, that you're not going kind of off the reservation and injecting things that you think it should have or you think it needs to do. You really need to make sure you're taking into account the functional and the non-functional requirements when you're building these. But again, I say start with the easier ones and then gradually work towards more complicated ones.
All right, so let me give you a concrete example, and I'm going to be trivial for a moment because it'll keep the discussion within bounds of something we can do with just audio. There is a very famous programmer problem called FizzBuzz. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And the idea is to have a program that prints 1, 2 fizz, and any number that's divisible by 3 gets a fizz, and any number that's divisible by, I think it's 5, gets a buzz, and if it's divisible by both, it gets fizz buzz, right? That's the problem you're trying to solve. When I was looking at putting together a test-driven development course for Pluralsight, the first test is an interesting question. Do you just test for the value 1 when the answer is dead simple obvious? Do you test for 1, 2, 3? How far do you go in that first test? Do you start with what's just blindingly obvious?
So it completely depends on your level of experience, right? If you read Kent Beck's book on XP, you know, and he talks about TDD, and you've got what's called the obvious implementation. When you are first learning how to do this, yeah, I would suggest you go to the exercise so you get to muscle memory, because what may seem dead simple obvious may not be, right? And a perfect example of that is, you know, if I'm writing an add function, dead simple obvious is return A plus B. But what if somebody passes in int.max and int.max? And you return A plus B, you don't get the sum of A plus B, you get int.min value because of overflow. Right. So whereas it seems dead simple obvious, it might not be. But, you know, the idea of the refactor is adding use cases. So, yeah, I would start with, you know, return 1 and then I add, you know, I pass in two, and my test will fail because it'll pass on the, you know, the instance or the use case when I put one in as a parameter, but it'll fail on two. Now I have to say, okay, you know, if parameter equals one, return one. If parameter equals two, return two. Now I pass in a three. So now I have an if statement in there. It's getting more complex. My cyclomatic complexity has gone up. I have to start thinking a little harder. And we go through the refactoring to clear out those things. It might be that you've got something that is so dead simple that when you add in additional use cases, that very first implementation is the right one and it's good enough.
Well, and going beyond that, as you start adding implementations, what seems simple at first may not be simple later. But even beyond that, we've all developed systems before. Requirements change. And having a test out there that reflects requirements, it may seem like a simple requirement today, but it might change down the road. And it's okay to change your test when the requirements change. But having that test, even for something that seems simple, is going to ensure that no matter what you do to that code later on, no matter what changes, that that case is always satisfied. So you can do what's called refactoring without fear. Is I can change that code no matter what. As long as my tests are all green, I know I'm still okay. And even for the simple things, because a lot of times things we think are simple tend to not be simple or tend to be overlooked, we're still protected there by having a test.
So I think it's interesting that you pointed out a few things that developers don't think about when they're solving a problem. We're problem solvers by nature, I think, and we get a problem and we jump to the solution and we don't think about what could go wrong or how things will change later. We solve the problem we've been presented. And I think it's really, like you were saying, to make you think about both those things, how will this solution hold up over time is really powerful. How does it change your thinking when you start thinking about what could go wrong as part of defining the problem? Do you know what I mean? Like, so as part of test-driven development and test-first development, your first job is to fail a test, right?
Well, yeah, your first job is to write a test that would pass if the feature, if the bug was fixed, you know, if you were successful in writing the code you needed to write to check the box that you finished that assignment, right? So what you're doing is you know the code doesn't do what you want it to. So you write a test to say, when this test goes green, the code does what I want it to. So that's how you write that first test. So if I'm writing FizzBuzz and I say, you know, in my test, create the system under test, and I run that test, and there is no class called FizzBuzz, then I get a compile failure. And that's the same as a failed test. I failed. I now have to make that pass. So I create a class called FizzBuzz. And now I run it and that passes. All right. There's my first use case. I actually have a class. Next, I say, all right, I'm going to pass in a one and I should get a one back. And I run it and it fails because that method doesn't exist. And so then I add the method. I run it. I still fail because I'm not getting a one back. So I can go into that method and say return one. And now it passes. So now I have to add a use case. And I know what your listeners are thinking. Yeah, what a pain in the butt that is, right? That's so obvious. You should just be able to do it. And after you've been doing TDD for a while, and I've been doing it for probably 7-8 years, you don't run the test every single time you make a class, right? You create your system under test. You use something like Just Code to create your class, to create your method, to set up that first assert. Then you run the test, right? So it varies how much of the test running you do. Based on your level of experience and how obvious implementation is, but I'm still writing the code as if I could run the test at any given point. Does that make sense?
Yes, mm-hmm. It does make sense. And it does talk to finding a rational medium of not writing things that are just silly. I think we would all agree, however, that the bigger risk is in skipping too far ahead and assuming things are obvious and then being hoist on that by the thing that turns out, as you suggested earlier, to be more complex or to have a slight twist or variant. The one thing, John, that you said that I'm a little cautious about was this idea of writing with future changes in mind, because that, I think, comes up against the idea of YAGNI, of you ain't gonna need it, and only coding what you need now, not what you anticipate needing in the future. And I'm not quite sure how you resolve that.
let me clarify what I was thinking there, because I do agree on that. And then James and Phil, you can tell me how I'm wrong. But what I meant by that is the nature of this kind of iterative development, where you're writing a little bit of code, you're testing it, you're writing a little bit more, and you're letting the code kind of evolve, requires you to break things apart, not to hard code things, to make things, you know, maybe use patterns like dependency injection and things like that earlier on. And if you get the right balance of that early, it can make things that would be very difficult later on in a project a lot easier. So I've seen that in a few cases where projects that started with tests earlier on got hit with a big change, and it's not so hard because it was just kind of the nature of making something testable also makes it, what's the word, flexible.
A little more open.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree. I think dependency injection, you mentioned that, is crucial for test-driven development. But even beyond that, it makes you think a little bit more about what you're building before you build it. Software developers are relatively okay about planning out for the future. But it kind of, when you're doing TD, it kind of makes you think about the corners you could potentially get painted into. Now, having said that, you don't want to go too far ahead. And I come from a consulting background, and we had a very strict rule: is if, unless a client asks for it, you don't build it, because you tend not to get paid for things like that. So with test-driven development, we're always trying to keep it open and flexible, because those big changes are going to come, and because just by the nature of how you write tests, it makes those tests easier to write. But to Jesse's point, you don't start injecting things that aren't part of those tests and aren't part of the specs until they get scheduled.
Let me move us forward a little bit into slightly more difficult territory. And I want to talk a little bit about dependency injection and mocking. And let's talk about sort of favorite or required tools. And feel free to put in Telerik tools and others. But what do I need besides a tester and a test runner and a mocking software do I need some kind of injection software, or can I just do that through constructor injection?
I prefer constructor injection for a couple reasons. For one thing, it makes me think about my dependencies. A lot of developers who are kind of new to this, they'll have classes with like 30 things in the constructor. And you kind of tell them, you know, that you need to think about this. So it helps you kind of really think about what do you really need. But the reason I like the constructor injection over, say, property injection is because if it's required by the constructor, I know I'm going to get, or constructor rather, I know I'm going to get something. I know something's going to be injected in, or else it's not going to be built. So it's not going to compile. With property injection, depending upon the framework you're using, you don't always know that something is going to be injected in. So you have to be able to check for whether you actually got that dependency. And if you didn't, you have to have a way to fail gracefully when you don't have access to what you were supposed to get access to.
Before you go on now, James, let me just ask you, for the constructor injection, do you do that by hand, or do you use something like Ninject, or what do you like to do?
So I prefer Ninject. The two biggies out there right now are Ninject and StructureMap, and you really can't go wrong with either one of them. I just prefer Ninject because Nate Kahari is a friend of mine. He built it. I knew if I had a problem with it, I could hit him up on Skype or whatever and get an answer. But that's really the only reason. StructureMap is great too. A lot of people have been successful with it. I think, especially if you're building a larger system, you're even just a medium-sized system, I think dependency injection framework is going to make your life so much easier. You can write a factory. That would be the alternative. But the problem is, as you start building more components in your system and it gets larger, it starts to be a little more difficult to manage that factory. Whereas with a dependency injection framework, I can just define my rules and I don't really have to worry about it. And if you're using something like StructureMap and Inject, which has plugins for things like MVC or Web API or even Web Forms or WPF, I can just know that when my application gets started, I can plug that in and the creation is just going to happen. I don't have to worry about getting instance of my factory, making sure my factory is correct, and then relying on that to work. I can just put my rules in and it's just going to work. And that I think is very helpful, especially when you start getting into larger systems.
So I think at this point, about half of Jesse's and John's listeners have just turned off this podcast because they are thinking, holy crap, I've learned all this stuff just to write a unit test. And my point to that is, and I totally agree with James, but that's not where you start. right? That's way too many moving parts to get this whole TDD thing under control. You can simply write injection yourself, right? Use something like Just Mock Lite, which is totally free and commercially supported, and I'm a big fan of it, and I've been very influential in the product, getting all the features I want in it, so of course it's my favorite. But you can just start by doing very simple constructor injection without using an IOC container and still have very effective unit tests. And as you get that under control, bring in a DI framework or an IOC framework. I totally agree that larger projects need them, but I think we might be scaring people off thinking that, oh, now I have to use Ninject or Unity or StructureMap just to get some tests written, right? So I think I want to separate those two concepts and let your listeners understand that, yeah, that's kind of like the black belt phase. But just to start to get some simple tests going to help drive your design, you don't need to have all that in there.
Okay. So go ahead, John.
So to continue off that maybe and see what you think of this. When I'm presenting ASP.NET MVC, one of the first things on the dialogue when you create a new MVC project is create a test project. And what I've been recommending to people is just always check that box.
Yes.
And the idea is you don't need to become an expert on TDD and all the frameworks and the black belt stuff to get started. And if you write one test that makes your code better, that's good, right? And so I've been telling people, you know, start with a unit test project. And the first time you get a bug, write that up as a test before you fix it. And then over time, you're going to have bugs that will, you know, that'll ensure that those tests will ensure those bugs don't pop up again, or will help you ensure that, right? Does that seem to what do you think of that?
I think yes, with an asterisk. The problem with the unit test project that ships with MVC is it uses MS test, and I'm not a fan of MS test. So I actually create my own test project, and I've actually got stuff up on my blog how to do this, and in my deck on learning MVC, where I create my own test project. I can hook it in through some registry tweaks and through some V6 settings, so that when I start my MVC project, I can check the box that uses just mock and NUnit instead of using MS test. But yes, they should be checking that box.
Now, is that something where to get started, you really need to understand the differences between the testing frameworks, or is that more of a get started and then figure out what you like and don't like by what works for you?
So MS test is very popular, and I think because it's built in, right? And you get some nice features when you're in the higher SKUs of MSDN and Visual Studio, and you get code coverage and things like that. The problem that I have with MS test is you learn a couple of bad habits early if you're using MS test, just because of the way it was implemented. And it can make it a little harder to move to more of a BDD style or behavior driven design, a style of testing, which is like the next level of unit testing, right? You go past TDD and you move right on to BDD, where you're looking at the entire behavior as opposed to the individual pieces.
Phil, one thing I just want to come back to very quickly is you said for using NUnit that you had to muck about with registries. Was that so that it's integrated when you click the create a test project? Because certainly you can use NUnit just by going to NuGet.
So you can certainly use NUnit without doing anything in the registry, but if you want to have your custom test project integrate into the MVC new project wizard, then you either need to create a V6 package, which is actually what I recommend, because you also do that through NuGet. But if you're just doing it locally on your machine and you don't want to create a V6 package or a NuGet package, you can just tweak a registry setting. And then your custom project template will show up in that new project dialog.
Right. And failing that, just to be clear, you can, on a project-by-project basis, use NuGet to just install it into that project.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can certainly right-click and say add new class library and use NuGet to get NUnit or MVUnit or, you know, whatever framework you want, and you can pull just mock down the same way from NuGet. You can do all that manually.
Okay.
But going to John's point of checking that box when you create a new MVC project to make sure that the references are there and some of the core libraries that you need to test MVC are there, you know, it's just something that, you know, it makes it less, how do I want to say it? There's less friction in doing it that way, which means it'll be more likely that people actually do it.
Let's talk about mocking for a moment. You mentioned JustMock, which is the one that I use. It's a Telerik product. It's there's a form of it that's free. And using it, once you sort of get your head around it, is quite easy. But can you talk a little bit about where mocking is best used and why having a mocking environment is so important?
Yeah, sure. So anytime you have a dependency that doesn't directly affect what you are testing, you want to mock that out. So for example, if I'm writing an application that's going to calculate the average SAT score of a group of high schoolers, do I want to have the database possibly affect the results of my test? So I am expecting that the average is going to be 1323 based on a set of students. James goes in, mucks around with the data because he's trying to test something else. Now my test has failed because the data has changed. The logic isn't wrong, but the data has changed. Now I'm going back to debugging as opposed to actually just fixing the test. So anytime you have a dependency that doesn't affect what you're testing, you want to mock it or you want to replace it with something that you completely control. And that's what a mocking framework allows us to do. It either creates a proxy if you're looking at the free versions, or it uses the profiler and IL injection to either change the behavior of an object, or in the sense of JustMock Lite, which is in the same realm of MOQ and Rhino and NMock and Mock It Easy, it creates a proxy around an interface. So if you're using dependency injection, you're passing around interfaces, not actual concrete classes. And you tell the proxy, hey, make an interface of the iStudent repository, or make an instance of the iStudent repository. And by the way, if somebody calls get students, here's how I want you to do, right? I want you to return this set of students. So right in the test, you see, all right, I'm using the iStudent repository interface. When I call get students with no parameters, here is the set that I'm returning. Based on that set, my math calculation in the get average SAT score method should return 1367. And I can see it all right there in the test. It's readable and I'm not dependent on anything outside of what I am trying to test. It makes it a true unit test. I'm sure James has something you'd like to add to that too.
Well, what I tell people is when you're testing, you want to make sure you're running, you have your concept of your test code under test, which is basically the method and any private methods that code touches. And you want to keep it isolated for a couple reasons. Phil touched on a couple of those. You want to make sure you're not stepping over somebody else's running tests, but also the reason I tell people to do it, and the thing I like about it most, is eventually your tests are going to fail at some point, like in all likelihood. When you have your test isolated by mocking all your dependencies, you have a smaller target to look at to diagnose that problem. If my test fails, I don't want to go looking through three different layers of architecture. I just want to look in between those two curly braces to find out what's breaking. So mocking helps with that as well. The other thing I really find it helpful for is we want developers running the tests pretty consistently, like every couple minutes, every time they make a couple changes, to make sure that, you know, they don't break something and then 2 hours later discover it. Hitting a database is very time consuming. Hitting a web service or any external resource is time consuming as well. A mock is an in-memory structure, so it's much faster to run the tests, and it encourages developers to keep running those tests consistently and make sure that they're going in the right direction.
What's the smallest program that it's worth doing test-driven development with?
I would say, and I'm maybe a little biased here, I would say anything that isn't a spike. And when I say spike, what I'm referring to is I just have a proof of concept. I have an idea, or I want to test this new framework, and I'm just going to a small little throwaway. That's the key, throwaway program to test my theory or to try this new framework. And even then, a lot of times I'll write those as a form of a unit test, because it's easier for me to test something by running a unit test than it is to call it either with a window or a web page or even a console application. If I'm playing with a new framework or playing with, Microsoft just did all this async stuff, maybe I want to play with those. It's easier to me to run that from a unit test than to build a test harness. So I can use those unit tests in a different way, but I think anything you're going to put into production, I really would have concerns not using TDD on it. And I know it's a little bit dogmatic, but again, coming from the background I come from, that would just be my thought process on this. And I'm sure not everybody agrees, and that's fine.
Well, and I'll even go a little step farther in that I don't want to write any code that doesn't have a test around it. It makes me feel dirty to write code without a test. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't taken long showers over my career to get over that. But I always try to have things under test. And even spikes, what I find myself doing at times, and this is why I really have gotten so fond of TDD and BDD, is I'll start writing a method and I'll be trying to think my way through it. And what used to happen is I would have ink all over my screen because I would, trace the method with the pen. And now what happens is my screen jumps all over the place because I have a touch machine.
When John and I were working on a project, we did some TDD, but John at that point was saying to me, we should really be looking at behavior-driven development, at BDD. Can you help me a little bit with what the difference is, and am I behind the curve if I'm doing TDD?
I wouldn't say you're behind the curve, but here's a big difference in my mind, right? So TDD, I am checking. Now we're really into Legos in my house, right? So with test-driven development or test-driven design, I am designing Lego blocks at the individual block level, and eventually I'm going to put these together to make some sort of spaceship. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to build one of these 3,000-piece Lego things without the instructions, but it can be quite daunting. So you know every individual piece works, but you don't necessarily know the end result is going to work. And I've got a picture from Legoland in Orlando, or in Florida, where it's a picture of a submarine, and it's all built out of Legos, huge submarine. Right. And the captain of the submarine, the hatch is open. He's looking through the periscope, and the periscope's on the outside of the submarine. And he has to have the hatch open so that he can look through the periscope. Now, I'm sure the unit test for the periscope passed. I'm sure the unit test for the hatch passed. And I'm sure the unit test for the captain patch passed. But when he put it all together, it totally defeated the purpose of having a periscope because he had to surface to use it. Whereas from a BDD standpoint, we approach it differently. So I might get a requirement, I need a ship that can do the Kessel run in 5 parsecs. And somebody's going to correct me because I think it's 4.5 parsecs, but regardless. And that's where I start. And I write a specification. And I actually put that in code, whether you're using spec unit or mspec or whatever. And then I'll drill down through specs that aren't passing or failing. They're just not implemented until I get down to that small level, which maybe is the cargo door to hold the smuggling contraband. Maybe it's the gun to shoot the TIE fighters, whatever it is. And then I start building my way back up. But what I have is I have a complete picture in code of how these things all fit together. And BDD for me is much more powerful because all that thinking that we do in TDD now is in code, right? So if I'm building the Millennium Falcon with TDD, I'm in my mind thinking, all right, I know what I have to end up with. Where can I start? I'll start with, the pulse rifle, the pulse cannon, and I'll build that. And then I'm going to start with this. And so you're doing all this thinking, but you're not capturing that information anywhere, right? So if you get hit by the proverbial bus in IT, which isn't physically getting hit by a bus, but getting that higher paying job across the street, you take all that knowledge with you, where in BDD, that's all in code.
Well, that was extremely helpful. I will tell you that Wikipedia says it's making the Kessel run in 12 parts,
Okay. Well, there you go.
So something I would just like to add to that a little bit is one of the benefits I see in BDD, we used it a little bit at my old company, was it's also a good way to bring the non-technical people kind of into the fold. If you go out and look at some BDD frameworks like SpecFlow, they allow you to write your specifications in language that's called GURK, and it's very easy for business users to work with. And then you can take that business language and turn it into executable tests. So in addition to everything Phil said, I also like it because I can bring my BAs, my business analysts, in, and they feel like they're really contributing, and they are. And it actually helps me, I think, keep the tests a little bit more in line with what the business is looking for.
But are the tests different? Are the tools different?
There's a little bit more tooling around it. The tools are built on the tools we're using now. So, for instance, I mentioned SpecFlow. That's built on NUnit. The tests are structured a little bit different. But if you're already doing TD and you already kind of understand how those tests work, these tests are very easy to understand. And actually, I think it makes the tests a little bit better because, again, you're writing, the business is dictating what the test should be testing. So there's a little bit more, they have a little more skin in the game. A guy I used to work with had a great phrase, you get their fingerprints on the murder weapon. So they buy in a little bit more themselves.
Well, and you mentioned Gherkin. Sorry to interrupt, but you mentioned Gherkin. That's only one type of BDD, which is the, you know, user story, given when, then syntax. I am much more a fan of the MSpec style, which was brought forth by Scott Belware many years ago, which is a much more simpler syntax. When I'm doing something, then this should happen, right? And it's really just much more human readable. Whereas the given when then and the user story syntax seems to be much more binary readable. But that's opinion.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did in this project, we just used the should project, which is up on Eric Hexter did that, and it's up on GitHub, and it just added those MSpec style should assertions to MS test. So, I mean, that's just a very basic level one. But, you know, one of the things that started pushing me in that direction on that specific project was we would be working on an implementation. We'd have a bunch of tests and a bunch of code, and then we'd say, you know what? We shouldn't even be on this screen to be doing this. We should move this, you know, this code should be over here. Or, you know, we should change our service architecture or whatever. And then we ended up rewriting tons of tests because they were all testing. They were focused on that fine-grained implementation. And like you were saying, Phil, with that, you know, kind of like testing each of the components on the ship instead of like where the ship's trying to go or what the ship's trying to do. And so that was a time where I thought, you know, at least as we're sorting out what's happening, how this design should work, it would be a lot easier to work at the behavior level and then maybe later have a combination, you know, some BDD style that tests the overall functionality, and then maybe also have some traditional unit tests that test out specific, you know, operation of the components once we kind of know what they're doing. Do you see that as like, it's not, is it an either or do you end up having both, you know, some BDD style, you know, kind of more acceptance test style testing around, you know, at the higher level, and then some, the addition of some unit tests at the lower level?
Yeah, so I see both, right? And it's interesting. A really good friend of mine, Lee Brandt, who does a lot of talks on BDD as well, he and I have gotten into many discussions over Scotch about this, right? Because he is 100% MSpec all the way. And I am 100% get the job done all the way. And sometimes that means MSpec, you know, for the behavior things. But sometimes, like, if I have a calculator function in there, I'm going to drop down to NUnit because I have a road test capability and I can still have one line of code in my test, but, you know, test 20 or 30 use cases. So really it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's temper your action with wisdom and do what works for you.
Yeah. And to add to that, I am a fan of also on occasion, if it's appropriate, writing unit tests for non-functional requirements. Those tend to be kind of difficult to write in a BDD style. So it's easy to drop back to the normal unit test style for those kinds of things.
What's a non-functional requirement?
Something that the user might not care about. Like, for instance, if I have an algorithm to save orders to an order database, I want to make sure maybe that save method only gets called once instead of, if it's in a loop, I don't want it being called every time in the loop. I want it to be called once at the end of the loop. Things like that. If I find, for instance, if I'm testing the code and I find it's taking a long time, I find that the save has been moved inside the loop, I might want to test to make sure, or have a test to make sure that is moved outside the loop and it only ever gets called once. That'd be like a non-functional thing. It's not really part of the user spec. I mean, obviously all users say I want it to be fast, but it's kind of more of a non-functional thing.
Got it. And Phil, you said that NUnit has a road capability. Is that what you said?
So with NUnit and MBUnit, you can have what's really a data-driven test. And this is a place where MS test has struggled over the years. And yes, you can do it, but it requires XML files and all sorts of crazy things. With NUnit, instead of having a test, you have a row test, and then you can use attributes to pass in parameters. So instead of having an empty method for your test, you actually have, you know, add end, you know, int one, int two, int three. So if I'm writing an add function and I want to test it, I can pass in one, two, and three as in one of the attributes, and those will get passed in, and I can say add 1, 2 should equal 3, right? Or A, B, and C. And so I can get a whole lot of use cases done without having to write a whole flock of lines of code. And so then if somebody comes back and a bug comes back and says, hey, somebody put int.max into both of these, you know, calculator fields, I can just add that as an attribute, those parameters. I now have a failing test. I can make a pass.
Got it. And that is clearly very useful.
Yep.
What about UI testing? Is that completely separate from everything we've been discussing?
Well, is it completely separate? Yes and no. Traditionally, it's been, you know, developers don't want to do it. That's QA's bailiwick. What I've been talking about for the past couple of years is developers should do at least some rudimentary UI testing. There's some caveats to that. UI testing is inherently slow. It can be difficult, but the tools have gotten much better. So, for example, Telerik makes a free tool called the Telerik Testing Framework. It's the foundation for their Test Studio product. But this allows me to use MBUnit, NUnit, MS Test, whichever test framework I want to use, to run UI tests against a multitude of browsers. And it's actually more art than science, whereas, you know, a lot of TDD, we've pretty much distilled down to a lot of science with some art mixed in. But UI testing really should be done by the developer, because it is our job to make sure the code does what we expect it to by the time we hand it off to the next level of testing.
So what do you guys think about continuous testing? That's something that I've enjoyed doing lately, is that, you know, the idea that you're actually seeing the results of the tests as you're developing. I know there's some popular ones. There's nCrunch, there's continuous test. Do the Telerik products support that? Or?
Well, so right now it's on our roadmap to add in continuous tests. So Just Code has a very comprehensive test runner built in. We work with all the major frameworks. We support the bridges and the test runners ourselves, so you don't have to depend on the open source community to make sure that the versions match up. I like the concept of continuous test. I haven't done it on a significantly large project. I've always seen it, you know, presenters are writing FizzBuzz or Hello World or, you know, a calculator app. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to see, because, I mean, I believe all of them are using a .NET profiler behind the scenes. I'd be interested to see what happens when you have a project of significant size that you're doing this on.
My only concern with it is, and I've always preached this to my development teams, was doing one thing at a time. You start with one test, you make that pass. You start with the next test, you make that pass. You start with the next test, you make that pass. And if you're running all these tests for historical purposes, that's great. But my only real concern with it, and it's a people thing, is I don't want it to encourage developers to go out and write six tests and then try to work on all six tests at once. I think they still need to focus on doing one thing at a time, because computers are great at multitasking. Humans are horrible at it. So as long as we can kind of keep people trained to do the one test approach, I think it could be really cool.